Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about Containership, a way to deploy your cloud applications in multiple clouds. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 444, recorded August 2nd, 2017, Containership. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Amazon Kinesis from AWS, a powerful new way to easily collect, process, and analyze streaming data so you can get timely insights and react quickly to new information. Learn more at kinesis.aws. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day, totally unaware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with. Joining me once again, Jonathan Bennett as my co-host. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Okay, and you're speaking to us in the wonderful state of Oklahoma again?
Yes. The corporate headquarters, the home office here in the flyover state of Oklahoma.
Very cool. Very cool. One of the few states that I have not been to in the United States, except by vertical position. So I've been 30,000 foot over it. I think that's as close as I've gotten to it. And if you're watching the video, you'll see behind me is this wonderful downtown skyline of Santa Monica. And I'm once again at ZipRecruiter headquarters, where I have basically fiber right to the backbone. So we have infinite bandwidth. But they told us, don't abuse it. Don't abuse it. I guess I know what that means. So no illegal activities are allowed on this extremely high bandwidth. So we're not doing that. We are not doing that. So anyway, this week we have yet another interesting project that I actually bumped into at OSCON back about a month and a half ago. This is Containership. Containership, by their own words, is multi-cloud Kubernetes made easy. That's their initial catchphrase. On one of the other web pages, I saw the following paragraph: Containership is an open source container management platform, which aims to be the simplest way to run containers from dev to production. Containership provides all the necessary pieces to your infrastructure, including load balancing, service discovery, and DNS in a single package, and extending the core functionality is easy through the use of plugins. I know containers are the big thing. Kubernetes, we had them on the show, I think like 8 weeks ago, somewhere in there. Right now here at ZipRecruiter, we're moving everything through in a Docker and into containers. Into Kubernetes, reworking everything so that we can do, we call it 12-factor apps, you know, trying to make sure that it all works at scale and does the right thing with modern practices along that line. And so I don't know much about Containership yet, except my first question is going to be like, how is this different from the other 10 or 15 projects that are in that arena, just so we can get what the differentiation is for that. I'm also a little curious about their licensing model. And about maybe their community involvement so far. I know they're a fairly young project, but that doesn't mean it's not already usable and mature. So, of course, those are more questions we're going to ask. Oh, who are we going to ask that of? We're going to ask that of Phil Doherty and Norman Joyner, who will be joining us in a moment, not to make too alliterative on the name there. Jonathan, what do you know about this so far?
One of the things that they mention in the website is this concept of multi-cloud. And I find that interesting. I'm wondering if they're referring to the ability to, you know, use Amazon AWS and the Google platform and Microsoft's Azure all at the same time for the same project. And so one of the things that we've seen that could be a problem is someone uses, you know, Amazon AWS for their hosting or whatever, and Amazon has a problem and goes offline for 20 or 30 minutes. And everything that is hosted on there goes offline for the same amount of time. And so if Containership is trying to get around that problem, that's something I'm definitely going to be interested to hear about. But we'll have to wait until we get them on the line and ask them and
right.
Let them speak for themselves.
We can guess all day. Yeah, we can guess all day. We can keep reading the online docs all day until we figure it out. But I think it's going to be much better just to talk to our guests. So without further ado, I do have one important piece of business here, which is that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by the Amazon Kinesis from AWS. In the information age, data is the new oil. Businesses need data, and there's no better data than real-time data, which is why Amazon Web Services built Amazon Kinesis, a powerful new way to collect, process, and analyze streaming data so you can get timely insights and react quickly to new information. Here's the thing. Websites, mobile apps, IoT sensors, and the like can generate a colossal amount of streaming data, sometimes terabytes an hour. That, if processed in real time, can help you learn about what your customers, applications, and products are doing right now and respond right away. Amazon Kinesis lets you do that easily and at a low cost. With just a few clicks, you can start sending data from the hundreds of thousands of data sources simultaneously. Loading in real time, it lets you process and analyze the data and take actions promptly. All you need to know is SQL. Kinesis also gives you the flexibility to build your own custom applications using popular stream processing frameworks of your choice. And with Kinesis, you only pay for the resources you use. There are no minimums, no upfront commitments. To learn more about Kinesis, just go to kinesis.aws and let's get streaming. That's KINESIS.AWS. And we thank them for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guests. Phil Daugherty, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm calling you from beautiful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the sun is actually shining today, which is not typical out here. but yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful hot day in Pittsburgh.
And let's also bring on Norman Joyner. Norman, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And where are you speaking to us from?
Also Pittsburgh.
Can you see each other? Are you like next to each other?
We are not.
Okay.
I'm actually working from the home office today, so.
Oh, even better.
The office.
Okay. Yeah. Sometimes we get guests that, like, if there's going to be two guests, they sit next to each other, and that gets in trouble because we hear the crosstalk of the audio back and forth. So that's why I'm in my notes, I always say, please make sure you're in separate rooms at least. So thank you for doing that. So, well, let me start with Phil. Give us a 30,000 foot view. What problem are people solving when they're reaching for container ship?
Sure. Well, the problem that they're solving is really hosting provider lock-in, and kind of like you guys just mentioned, having the flexibility to be able to kind of run the same way across multiple providers is a challenging problem. And also, when it comes to just high availability, being able to do that is kind of paramount, especially in this day and age. So, we just had an Amazon outage again this past week, and we're really trying to create a solution that makes it easy for developers or, companies of any size or skill level to be able to take advantage of that ability.
Well, that is a really interesting problem to solve. And if you solve it correctly, people will be beating down your door, because I know, like, for Amazon, within Amazon can do things like, well, this machine died, so we're rolling over to that machine. But how do you then coordinate that if all of Amazon goes away and without even telling you that they've gone away, and be able to roll it over, say, to Azure or DigitalOcean or any of the other cloud providers that are out there?
Sure. Yeah. So, I won't say that we've 100% solved the problem yet, but that's kind of the mission that we're on. Where we're at today is that, you're able to deploy, manage, and kind of run things in exactly the same way, scale out across, but we have 14 different cloud providers, so all the major ones and some that maybe people have never heard of. So you're going to get the same workflow and kind of the same usability no matter where you're running. There are some issues that are going to come up, like, when it comes to data replication, that are still troublesome depending on the type of app you're running. If it's stateless stuff, that works perfectly fine today. There's a couple other hoops you kind of got to jump through to really do active across clouds using us. That said, we do have customers that are doing that, that are running on Google, Azure, and Amazon all at the same time, and also kind of using that to be able to expand, regionally or into some stuff takes off in another country or other part of the world, they can easily kind of expand there without having to kind of redo everything again.
So how did ContainerShip get started?
So Norman and I actually worked together at a previous job, and we were building mobile commerce, basically the back end that powered a bunch of retailers' mobile sites and apps. And we were using some other cluster schedulers, and this was like pre-Docker kind of, Mesos was really the only solution that was available. And it worked for us, but it was really complicated. So we started looking into ways that we could make this more simple and give kind of the power of like a cluster scheduler to users who didn't maybe have the expertise to dig in and learn Zookeeper and all these other million parts that you really had to have to kind of stand things up and get things going. So we started working on it just as a fun side project after work, until it got to the point where it was actually like pretty cool. And we thought maybe we should actually do something with this. So we applied for TechCrunch Disrupt Startup Battlefield back in 2015 and got accepted into that, which was a crazy experience because, you know, it really wasn't a company per se. It was a project. We kind of had to turn it into one on the fly, if you will.
Okay. Let's go ahead and bring on Norman again for a second. What's your relationship to Containership? And you obviously started it right with Phil. So you've been with the company the entire time?
Yep, that's correct. I am the CTO. As Phil said, we founded it together and previously worked at together. So I've been here the whole time. It's been an exciting ride so far, and I really look forward to continuing down the path we're going.
So do you do all the coding, he does all the bossing, or how does this work?
Essentially, that's a good way to put it, yeah.
Called that one right away. So I presume you have other people working on this with you at the company, right?
Yeah, we do. We have a handful of other developers that report to me that are working on it, all different parts of the project. So open source parts and then also our SaaS product as well.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about that. So what does this actually consist of? What are the building blocks in this thing?
Sure. So when we originally started, as Phil mentioned, there weren't really other cluster schedulers out there. So we built Containership Scheduler, which is similar to Kubernetes or what Kubernetes is today. And that was basically the basis for what we were going to do. So to turn it into a product then, we basically built a SaaS product around that makes it easy to deploy the scheduler to 14 different cloud providers, which we're constantly adding to. And in this SaaS product, we can layer features on top of that, such as user management, load balancing, firewall rules, service discovery, all these components that we can build once in, you know, a cloud agnostic way and have them work across any cloud provider.
Well, so a lot of this has also been being built along, you know, as you're building your company. At the same time, a lot of other people are doing these things too. Is this sort of a race to see who can get the best one earliest, or are you guys all cooperating and using each other's technologies?
I think that kind of depends. Like, in some cases, we're using other people's technology if it makes sense. We kind of took the stance early on where even if there was a project available that we could potentially use for something, if it didn't fit like a glove kind of into what we were trying to do, then we would kind of build it ourselves. And what that let us do is kind of, you know, have more control over the direction we wanted to take things. If we needed a feature, we could add it. We didn't have to wait for somebody else to do it. That said, as you mentioned on our website, multi-cloud Kubernetes. Actually, Kubernetes for us is a recent addition where we basically are, you know, added support for using other schedulers under the hood, underneath our container as a service platform. So that we just released actually in the last week or so. But, you know, you can choose to use our scheduler or Kubernetes. And, you know, we're open to using other tools down the line, especially with, you know, our team right now is 12 people. So it's definitely a race kind of to see who can build the best product and make the easiest experience. And, you know, being able to take advantage of the massive community of people out there working on open source software can definitely benefit us when it comes to getting features released to users more quickly.
Well, so how have you been involved with the open source community? Are you finding outside contributors already? Are the people interested in this project?
Yeah, we've had some pretty good interest in more like certain components that we've built. So we have like a dynamic DNS server that powers part of service discovery, and have had quite a few people contribute to that and use it. I would say that when it comes to like the overall scheduler, though, it kind of plays into why we've really added Kubernetes support, in that their community is just massive and kind of just steamrolled everybody else that was working on scheduler technology. I mean, even Mesos kind of is had the limelight taken away. So we're kind of more focused now on how we can maybe offer the best container as a service platform using other open source tools. And, you know, we do everything we can to contribute back to those as well.
Hey, I wanted to jump in and dig a little deeper in the tech here, ask about how the gears turn together. Some of what you're describing, particularly the multi-cloud, sounds very similar to a load balancer and failover. Is that kind of the equivalent of what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, so that piece, the way we look at it is this, is that there's a couple of different ways to look at multi-cloud, right? So one way is that, like you mentioned, active, running across multiple clouds at the same time. That's certainly the end goal. Like I said, there's still some pieces that are difficult or hard to make fit in all kind of cases, and we haven't really tried to tackle yet. One of those is kind of like a global load balancing solution. But, you know, we like to more or less tell our users that it makes more sense to keep your traffic for a certain application in a certain data center or certain cloud provider. But, you know, what a lot of people are doing is just running different types of services or applications on different cloud providers and then having kind of the single pane of glass that, you know, hooks into CI and CD and has all the, you know, the same tools and features that you want to use. And you don't have to kind of learn all the intricacies of each individual cloud provider to do that. So today we're not really offering that kind of global load balancing solution. That said, it's something that you can certainly do. And one way that's fairly easy is to just use a GeoDNS solution. So, you know, basically sending traffic to a certain cluster that you have running on our platform, dependent on, you know, where a user's located, so they're going to get the fastest experience. But yeah, definitely down the line, we're looking into ways to kind of blur the lines more between cloud providers, and, you know, definitely offer a solution where it's, you know, a single cluster can kind of span them. But we're not really there yet today.
And this, you mentioned a pane of glass, and then we've also talked about the idea of a failover, and you said you're using GeoDNS. Where does this exist? Do you guys host it on hardware yourself, or is it also just a piece of the cloud that you've wrangled?
Our product, you mean, generally speaking, our product is great because it runs on itself, so we can run it wherever we want, and that's what we do. So we've had it running in various different cloud providers over the years now, and one of the interesting things, one of the cool features that we haven't really talked about yet on the show today is our snapshot feature. And the name can be a little underwhelming because you think snapshot and it makes you think you're like taking a backup of your database or something. But what our snapshots do is actually let you take kind of a point in time snapshot of your entire kind of data center schema. So if you have configured firewall rules, load balancers, your user management and ACLs, all of your services and how they link together and how many of them are running and the number of machines that you're running on, you can basically take a snapshot of all of that and then restore it to a different cluster that could be running on a different cloud provider or a different region of the same cloud provider. And that gives you some pretty cool superpowers in that, you know, you can really literally move your entire stack between providers kind of like with the click of a button, more or less.
So we do have an active chat room, and Emily the Strange has asked a couple of questions. They basically boil down to this. Have you gotten any pushback from cloud providers yet saying, no, we don't want people to be able to jump from one to another that easily?
I would say that it depends on the provider. We haven't really got any pushback per se. I would say that the opposite, the better way of putting it is that not a ton of support and help is a little more like it. So the interesting thing is that when you use our platform, you actually plug in your own kind of cloud credentials into it. So what we're doing is making API calls to the cloud provider on your behalf. And those machines that you're launching are actually launched into your cloud account. So unless the cloud providers want to stop their users from having API access, there's really not a lot they can do at the moment. But that said, certain providers, like our good friends over at Packet.net, have taken a completely different approach to this. And you know, they've really embraced you know, products like ours and have really built their platform around supporting them fully. And we think that's pretty cool. So you know, it just depends on the provider.
So that does segue well into another question I had, and that is, how do the different providers compare to each other when used under your service? So, you know, there are some of them that are good at big data, perhaps, and others that are good at, you know, a front-facing website for customers. Do you guys kind of level the playing field so that all of this works essentially the same for all of the different providers you can plug in?
Yeah, I mean, so really our platform is just using, if it's an infrastructure as a service provider that has virtual machines and it has an API, it's compatible with our platform. So when it comes to like specialty services, like you guys mentioned, Kinesis as, you know, sponsoring the show. Thank you, Amazon. You know, that's yeah. Something that we're obviously not replicating Kinesis into like Azure, for example, right? We can't do stuff like that. But, you know, so you're still going to have to, if you want to use those specialty tools, you're going to kind of have to stay on that provider. So we're not really capable of doing that. But what we have been trying to do is to make it easier to deploy open source software that can be comparable to some of the services that are provided by the cloud providers. So, you know, we have a marketplace full of, I think, like 60 or 65 different open source tools, things like Elasticsearch and the Elk Stack, where you can, you know, that can be sort of cumbersome to set up and to manage. And, you know, with us, it's really simple. You click to deploy and you get the whole stack stood up for you. All your logs start sending there basically without you having to do anything. If you add more machines to the cluster, it automatically scales out. So our vision is that, you know, we think that a lot of these tools that the cloud providers are offering are great, but they're also, they really do lock you in, because once you start using them, if there's not, you know, another solution on a different provider that is, you know, is equal to that, you kind of don't have a choice but to stay there. So we think that, you know, trying to get there with open source tools is kind of the way forward. And so that's really the path we've kind of gone down.
And so my follow-up to that is, like, you know, the one problem with abstraction is that it hides the differences, but that also means then you don't get the nuances of what the differences were. Like, let's say you have a universal way to launch a Docker container, okay? So every provider's got one of those, but some of them might have and ensure that it's on the same machine as this other container that I'm already running, so that I get tight network connections. And maybe another provider doesn't provide that. Does that mean in your interface you would not be able to provide that because it wouldn't be applicable across all platforms?
I think that actually is true. So, I mean, we definitely don't do anything that isn't going to be applicable. I can't speak English today either, across all platforms. That said, I mean, we've tried to build, you know, things into our platform that allow you to do those types of things. So, you know, for example, we have constraints that you can set where you can say, I want to deploy this service and it needs to live on servers of this type that I gave this certain tag to, or I need to run, this service alongside this other service always. So, you know, or I want to run a minimum or a maximum, or I want to run this many on every single host. So we've kind of tried to take a lot of those concepts and build them into our platform. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, yeah, you're going to miss out on some of those nuances that the individual providers have added. But in the long run, if we can kind of build those same features into a cloud agnostic platform, then I think that puts us a lot further ahead.
It sounds like you're doing for a container deployment what LiveVert did for virtual machines a few years ago then.
Yeah, kind of in a way, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely trying to standardize across all the providers, because I think like I was trying to get at there is that the reason that people end up staying with a cloud provider forever is really because of their automation tools. Right. When it comes down to it, yeah, I mean, obviously there's security, there is compliance, and obviously performance, right? But outside of that, for the most part, people are moving because they're staying on a provider because they want tools that make their job easier. And that's really it. So if you can kind of take that power away from a huge cloud provider, then, you know, that old data center in your town starts to look a lot more appealing when you can have that same automation running there that you can have running anywhere. So that's sort of, we think, where things are going to head eventually, is to take less power away from these big three, hopefully, and spread it out to run on any server, any computer, really.
Okay, and we have a question from the chat room that actually probably is more of a technical question, which is from Epony asks, or Epony, I forget which way he wants to say that. How frequently do they have to fix the APIs to match the cloud providers, and is it a plug-in type of software setup?
I can take that one, Norman.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, it's been pretty infrequent in terms of API breaking changes. Luckily, most of the APIs we're working with are versioned, and we can basically control the calls we're making and make sure that those kind of things don't break. That being said, we do have tests that run constantly to make sure everything is working as expected in terms of cluster launches. So that really hasn't been an issue that we've run into yet, but it's definitely something we're aware of and are constantly testing against.
And one of the advantages you have there, I guess, would be that the APIs can't change very often, or else they'll piss off all the customers, right?
Basically, yeah, that's why they're pretty good about versioning them and pegging them to a certain, a certain schema and API, and then introducing new APIs that have new features, which we can then upgrade to when we're ready.
We actually haven't talked yet about what's the UI here. Am I editing text files and typing commands, or is there some sort of a nice GUI on a web form? Is there a way to do both?
Yeah, there's a way to do both. So we have a CLI. Which obviously any developer might like to use, an API for direct calls for programmatic access. And then through Containership Cloud, the SaaS product, there's a very nice web UI that we spent a lot of time making as simple as possible, as easy to use as possible. As Phil said, I think earlier, one of the initial goals of the company was to make running containers in production as simple as possible. That was one of the core mantras. So the UI goes into that. So we make it as simple as possible to manage all these different clusters on different cloud providers. And that kind of goes back to the single pane of glass and managing everything in the same way, whether it's a public cloud, a private cloud, or that data center down the street Phil's talking about.
Okay, so I could run some equivalent software on my own bare metal and be able to talk to Containership APIs?
Yeah, that's correct. So if you were to install our open source agent on servers you had in your closet and install our cloud plugin, it will connect back to our SaaS product, and it'll look the same as an Amazon cluster or a Google cluster, and you'll manage it in the exact same way.
Well, that's still a plus. I seem to remember talking to other projects that are already doing something like this, but you're probably the furthest along on that one. And now I want to get geeky. What's this all written in, and what technologies have you used?
Sure. It's almost entirely in Node. We have a little bit of Go and a little bit of Clojure now, but mostly Node.
And
then our front
those?
End is React.
React, okay. And yep. Why those? How'd you choose those?
Probably because I have the most experience in Node. When we started it, it was the reason why. And then we kind of continued down that path. But there's a lot of tools in the DevOps or this space that are written in Go. And I think in writing it in Node is definitely a differentiator. And I think it's something that the Node community in general would be very interested in, or is very interested in, as it's a complex distributed system written in Node. So I think it's interesting.
Cool. And also because, Node is a very popular technology, you'll get plenty of contributions and plenty of things you can borrow from in your thing. Doesn't that mean you spend all day in, is it TypeScript now, or still using JavaScript?
Still using JavaScript, but maybe TypeScript, yeah.
So your brain has now been properly warped to understand JavaScript at both front end and back end levels, I can understand, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Every time I pick up JavaScript, I go, I only hate it second bad to Java. So I'm like, it's my second least favorite language now.
At least it's not the worst, yeah.
Yeah, Java beats that out just slightly, because I was going to make a joke earlier. We're talking about how Containership sort of levels the playing field in that sense, that you're using the same same API calls to call what may be differentiating behind it. I always like to make the joke that Java makes every programmer equally unproductive. So it's easier to hire people because they're only going to get this much productivity out of them, no matter how good they are. So yeah. Anyway, I've got a couple more questions for Phil. So I'm looking at the web page that has the various levels of license, various levels of product, and I'm seeing quite a huge jump between what I think is the community edition and the next step up, including things like firewalls and load balancing and stuff. Do you not have open source versions of those, or is that just the way you're presenting it on your commercial page?
No, so the firewall stuff, actually all of it is kind of available via API. So I guess the only thing on there that's not available in open source is the snapshot and restore and the load balancing stuff. Everything else is available. So the firewall stuff is all implemented as a plugin. I guess maybe Norm actually probably be better to answer that. But okay. Generally speaking, like everything that you see there is available, except the only thing that's not open source really is what we're kind of building as the SaaS product to try to sustain this business, which, you know, gives you the snapshotting and the user management and the load balancing. So that stuff's only available within Containership Cloud. But everything else, you know, is open source. And, you know, on our pricing page, we have you can see that you can run unlimited services for free. So what that means is that you can sign up and you can deploy Kubernetes clusters across any of the providers we support and deploy all your services. Except, you know, we're not like those premium features are really what we're trying to use as a gate to get people to upgrade. But we think that our pricing really is pretty good. pretty good. We're charging per service. So we don't, why that's interesting is for us, a service is, you know, a container image and its configuration. And you can actually scale that out and be running 1,000 containers for that service and it's still $8. So, it's pretty price competitive, and we don't care how many servers you run or how many clusters or any of that other stuff. It really just comes down to the service. But yeah, on the open source side, I think the only pieces that aren't available are the snapshotting and the load balancing.
Well, but I'm staring right at the page right now, and it looks like it says the community support edition, it only has one user. How are you restricting that if it's open source and I've just downloaded it and running it on my own?
Oh, no, we're not. So you're looking at that's all the pricing for like the SaaS product.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So go ahead.
So yeah, the SaaS product you log in through using GitHub or Bitbucket, and can just basically plug in your cloud providers and start and you're off to the races. On the open source side, you're going to download the agent, like Norm mentioned, install that on a handful of servers. They're all going to find each other and cluster together. And then there's an API and a CLI to interact with that. And you can connect it back to our SaaS product to manage it. But, you know, we're keeping some of those features gated basically in the SaaS product. But on the open source side, you can have as many people as you want managing it via the API or the CLI. And we do have an open source UI as well. It is definitely not as feature rich as the SaaS product, but we'll let you do things like create services and scale them, kind of see the hosts that make up your cluster, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so I'm looking at your GitHub page here, and I'm seeing. I thought you said Legoland, but it's Legion D. My mind is playing tricks on me. It's not. Like, you should call it, make a product called Legoland and confuse people with that. But no,
well, okay.
Trademarked.
And so, but if I'm just looking at this the GitHub pages and download the stuff that's there, and I see projects like Containership and Quarry and Prater and Legoland and Myriad KV. What are those? Can you tell me a little bit more about what I'm looking at there?
Sure.
Yeah, Norm, take it away.
So
yeah.
Most of those are just components, basically node modules that make up the Containership agent. So that repository is just Containership/Containership. Basically, that requires all of these other modules that do certain things, such as Legion D, which is a distributed event emitter over the network that basically lets the servers talk to one another. And on top of that, we have Prater, for basically coordinating a leader's leader election. Quarry is the DNS service that runs on each node in the cluster to facilitate service discovery. So basically all different components that make up the greater agent that will be run by the end user.
So Praetor would be closest to, say, console?
Actually, Myriad KV, which is should also be on there, would be closest to that. It's a distributed key value store that's built on top of Praetor and Legion D.
Okay, and but I know there's other projects that are similar to these. So you said you wanted to build your own just to make sure that it had the features you wanted when you wanted them. But it might be interesting. Well, I think we've actually probably covered enough about that. I mean, yes. So you have open source. Now, is this the kind of thing that I can start with, and then if I decide no, I don't want to manage all the moving parts myself, I just want to fire off containers, that I can take the configurations that I wrote here and just move them up to your hosted service?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's the same schema, right? So, yeah, you'd be able to just basically post those to the cloud, ContainerShip Cloud SaaS API, and they'd be created on your cluster just like you were, you know, running it on a local cluster.
And how does are you actually using the public GitHub as your code development base, or do you have a separate GitHub that you're snapshotting from to do this?
No, we're just using public GitHub.
Okay. So this is the live code. This is what you're running in the cloud right now. Maybe a slightly back rev version of it, but at least this is what you're running. That's good. And yep. So are people contributing to this then, or is this what people are looking at and making contributions and fixing bugs and things like that?
Yep. All of the repos under ContainerShip is what people would be contributing to. Yep.
And so what drives the roadmap then? Is that's still something you're in business. You want to make your company work, but are you listening to what your customers are asking for and trying to accommodate?
Definitely. That really has kind of driven all of our direction. I think that Norman and I had a pretty good intuition about what people were going to want early on, just because, you know, we've been doing this forever. I started out, you know, working at a dedicated web hosting company like 12 years ago. So I moved all the way through all that fun of like manual migrations and learning all the guts of Linux and the tools and the networks and all that, all the way up to kind of where we are today. So, you know, we have a pretty good general idea of the things that we need to build. And then we definitely take into consideration what people are asking for. And that really is what kind of drives the decision-making process in terms of what to work on next. Because, you know, we have not a massive team. Like I said, we have 12, and out of that, nine developers. So we can't build everything. So we definitely, you know, we definitely listen to what our users have to say. If we didn't, I think we'd be pretty foolish.
Well, I think I want to then re-raise the question that I raised at the opening of the show. Okay, why would I be particularly interested in ContainerShip and not in one of the other competitive solutions? And maybe you can actually name them so you can say why you're better than them.
Sure, yeah. I mean, so I'd say like the products that people compare us most to would be like Mesosphere or Rancher Labs. I think that, well, at least in terms of Mesosphere stuff, it's extremely complex, and it's not really a single pane of glass. It's kind of like, yes, it's open source. Yes, there's a user interface, but it's for one cloud provider at a time. So if I was managing Google and Amazon and Azure, I'd have three different UIs with three different sets of configuration that I'd have to manage. So that's definitely a differentiator there. On the Rancher side of things, it is open source, and I think they are pretty similar to us. For us, I think that the place where we're able to have an advantage there is the onboarding flow. Just because for us, if you want to use ContainerShip Cloud, if you go look at like the documentation for a lot of these competing projects, it can look interesting to like a Linux techie or someone like me maybe, but 10 pages of like SSH commands and things I need to run to get things stood up is a lot more difficult for someone that's trying to figure out an easy way to do this compared to our solution, which, you know, really you're logging into with your GitHub or Bitbucket, plugging in some credentials, and then getting like a really easy kind of wizard that walks you through a cluster creation and all the other steps you need to take. So we, like Norm said, we definitely are trying to make it as easy as possible. And like Kubernetes, on the other hand, you know, that's something that we, you know, we maybe begrudgingly at the beginning decided to add support for, but the growth of that community and the speed with which they're able to kind of add features and move the project along couldn't be denied. And a lot of people come to us and, you know, before we had Kubernetes support actually released in production, and they'd say, oh, well, we're trying to use Kubernetes. And be like, well, how's that going? They're like, well, we've been at it for like 6 months and we're like not really there yet. So I think people need to remember that a lot of these tools that you hear a lot about, they are extremely powerful, but they can be pretty low level. So there's a lot of other stuff you're going to need to kind of build or build around those and build on top of to really get to the point where you have a platform that's going to offer self-service to development teams, and you can, you know, run without kind of having a heart attack every time you have to do an upgrade or modify things. And it just takes a lot of management overhead to kind of do it yourself.
Hey, I wanted to jump back in and ask a couple more questions. So as much as you're willing to comment on it, what kind of uptake have you gotten on this? Do you have any really big customers that you want to brag to us about?
Yeah, so we've had actually really good numbers when it comes to like the free tier and signing up and playing with it. So thousands of signups there, you know, hundreds of active users. I'd say the biggest kind of project, most well-known name that we've worked with so far is we ran the build system for the React Native project for Facebook. So if you go to their repo and GitHub, there's a nice container ship directory there. So we containerized all of their stuff for them and kind of built a scalable Jenkins setup that sped up builds from like an hour and 20 minutes to 20 minutes. But cool. You know, most of the companies that we work with are kind of like mid-market or like medium-sized startups, because they're really the ones that don't necessarily have all the resources and expertise on staff to be able to kind of build all the stuff themselves. That said, we definitely have had a lot more interest recently from enterprise and are, you know, in the middle of some really interesting conversations with some very, very large, well-known names that I cannot mention. But, you know, I think that it's still early days even for, you know, bigger enterprises as they're kind of like evaluating the landscape and, you know, aren't necessarily jumping straight into decisions, but are kind of testing out the waters and seeing what works best for them. But, you know, multi-cloud, which we, you know, obviously tout all over the place, is definitely huge when it comes to enterprise these days, because they're really interested in how they can leverage different cloud providers and kind of make the lives of their IT staff and their developers easier. So a lot of them are still kind of like, you know, baking VM images and taking 10 hours to do deployments and all kinds of horrible, horrible stuff that I just could not even imagine. So I think it's definitely still a little bit early, but definitely seeing a bigger uptake in interest and people coming on wanting to pay to use the product.
So Epony in the chat room asked something that I was thinking about earlier. So we've talked a little about the open source side of this and self-hosting. If someone wants to self-host and get started on a server in their closet or, you know, a data center, wherever, is it even an option to completely self-host and not attach to you guys and the software as a service solution at all? Can we run that entirely self-contained?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Norm, why don't you take that one?
Sure. Yep, that's definitely possible. As Phil mentioned earlier, there's a CLI API and an open source UI that you can run just for open source installs. So it's not required that you install that cloud plugin, which connects it back to the SaaS product at all. So it's fully self-sufficient, standing alone.
All right, just wanted to make sure we got the clarification on that. So I have found that startups doing innovative technology like this, oftentimes it gets applied in odd ways or very challenging ways. Is there a story you have of the craziest, or we could say the most traumatic deployment that you guys have done?
Let me think about that for a minute. I don't know about in terms of container ship. Luckily, we've been pretty blessed. I mean, I'll say this. Every single deployment always has some little intricacies to it that make it a challenge in its own right. For the most part, we've been fairly blessed in that we haven't had to deal with anything too insane. But Norm and I have definitely seen our battles in the past. especially at kind of previous jobs, and actually one that happened to us, which led us to start Containership really and actually take it seriously, was Black Friday 2013 or was it 2014, Norm?
I think 14, yeah.
Yeah, 2014. We were using a competing product that was in its early days and decided that we were going to be living on the edge and run it in production. So managing like 250 retailers, mobile sites and apps, and we made a change basically that sent an extra API call, like one request per second, to this competing product's API. And then when traffic started to really pick up on Black Friday, you can imagine we had like half of all these retailers' traffic flowing through us. the cluster melted down. Right. So what that means is that like things were just die. Like the cluster lost state. It had no idea where stuff was running. It was just a nightmare. So we basically were awake for like 3.5 days trying to figure out what the heck was going on until we finally tracked it down to this one request per second hitting this API. As soon as we discovered that, everything went back to normal and everything was hunky-dory. Of course, you know, you had a lot of ticked off retailers wondering what the heck happened. That said, you know, we were handling quite a large number of requests per second there. Everyone is, it's like Thanksgiving. Everybody's like getting on their phone. They're stuffed full of turkey, trying to buy some stuff. And then there's Norm and I basically like sweating bullets trying to get this thing back up. So that was kind of like the traumatic experience that really pushed us to say, okay, this thing is not really that scalable yet. And it's getting all this popularity and our thing is fast and simple. Let's do something with this. So here we are.
And so where does Containership go from here? What's your future plans look like?
Sure. You know, so for us, we're going to continue to do more and more to support the feature set within Kubernetes. Like, you know, like you said, we definitely see that. Kubernetes is certainly won the orchestration war when it comes to cluster schedulers. So we're going to do more and more to add better support for a lot of the more intricate features within Kubernetes. Today we have support for most of the core things, but there's certainly a lot more work to be done there. Also, we are, you know, trying to continue to expand the footprint of providers that we support and starting to look into ways to support, you know, providers that are maybe not, you know, these hugely massive cloud providers, but are, you know, smaller tier two and tier three providers, which can, you know, offer, you know, much better lower pricing for, you know, end users. And, you know, if somebody signs up for Containership, they may not necessarily care where their stuff's running for dev and test. And if they can get a really, really good price on that, that can be really appealing to them, and we can pass that through to them, that cost savings. So looking into some ways of doing that and just really continuing to kind of, basically perfect a lot of these features that we've added. Definitely just work on cleaning up the code that we already have. And obviously just spending more time kind of just like listening to what users want, trying to make the UX as great as we can. So that's sort of what I'm thinking. Norm, you have anything to add to that?
Nope, that's basically what I was thinking. So.
And along that line, what kind of people are you missing that might want to contribute something to scratch their particular itch? Are you missing? Is what future features and the prioritization of those in the GitHub so people can see? Oh wait, I do want to write some code about that. Is that already in the GitHub somewhere?
There are definitely some issues out there related to future roadmap. So poking around those directories or repositories rather, like the Containership one, that's where those would be. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Having said that, we're almost out of time, so I do want to make sure that we get in everything that I have one particular question as well. So you said you started this, was it as a TechCrunch project?
We started it just for fun, really, but we just applied on a whim for Startup Battlefield. So, you know, if you've seen the show Silicon Valley, we had to go up there and, you know, speak in front of a few thousand people. So that was good fun. But that's kind of where we got our first kind of boost from doing that in our first bit of exposure, which, you know, helped us to raise a little bit of money to work on the project and kind of went from there.
Hey, so I'll jump in. Is there anything that we haven't asked you guys about that you really just want to get off your chest and tell us about?
Oh, man. Those are like, those questions are always the toughest because I'm like, they probably are, but no, not really. I mean, I think we covered a lot today. We definitely are interested in people that are, you know, wanting to help contribute to the project and help kind of move things along. And we obviously care a lot about open source. But no, I don't think so. Norm, what about you?
I don't think so. I think that was pretty good.
Okay, well, I'll follow up my other question, which is, so you had an idea of what you wanted container ship to be when you did the Silicon Valley thing. What's been the most surprising direction the project has taken in the subsequent 2 years?
For me, I think it's that, you know, our initial kind of like thesis was based off of what when I worked at this managed hosting company back in the day, I used to have to like migrate servers constantly. So we'd get like a huge customer that had like, you know, 400 machines and we had to migrate them. And that meant actually going in, like looking at all their configuration and rsyncing tons of data and all this craziness. And it was just this horrible, painful thing. So really when we started Containership, the first feature we really built was the snapshotting to be able to let you kind of move between cloud providers. So that kind of, I think it's been surprising in that, like, that feature is still there, but we definitely have, more than I would have expected, kind of moved towards this multi-cloud path. And I think that's really been, looking back on it, it's, like, really where we were destined to go. But the interesting thing for me, too, is that when we started talking about this early on, people were like, why would I ever want to run across multiple cloud providers? That doesn't make any sense. Like, why would I do that? And now, finally, it's like, we're not crazy. The market is, like, you know, catching up to what we thought was how it was going to be, and suddenly multi-cloud is becoming this big thing. So that, I think, has been surprising, but also kind of a blessing that we weren't completely nuts, and, you know, we actually had a pretty decent idea.
Yes, you were ahead of the curve, and so you've actually had some implementation time and some experience that other providers are going to have to catch up to, or other developers have to catch up to. So that is pretty cool. Okay, yeah, we're almost out of time. I got two final questions I have to ask both of you, or my audience actually does email me and say, why didn't you ask these two questions? So if you've seen any of the previous shows, you know what they are. So the questions will be, what's your favorite scripting language, and what text editor do you use all day? Start with you, Phil.
Pretty much don't really write any code anymore. So I'm just going to have to just go with, I guess, Bash, because if I'm doing anything, I just write a quick shell script. And I still use Vim. So thankfully.
Okay. Norman, bail me out here. Hopefully you use a better editor.
I use Vim.
And scripting language? Probably JavaScript, right?
It is JavaScript, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Probably not the answers you wanted to hear.
No, it's okay. You know, I always like honest answers to these questions because just my way to keep the pulse, you figure on the pulse of what's going on. So hey, this has been great. I was sort of thinking going into this that that this is something that's just maybe only mildly interesting, but now I'm starting to think that I should be telling this to everybody that I meet. This is sounds like a very fascinating project, and that also lets you know that you probably don't have the best elevator pitch on your website either. The fact that at the beginning of the show it's been changed now that I've actually talked to you, so maybe rethink your elevator pitch on your website. But otherwise, not trying to slap you on the head on the way as I'm sending you out. This has been a great show. More people are going to be interested in this now. Thank God we had this full hour of conversation. And so thanks, Phil and Norman, for coming on the show and talking to us about Containership.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks. Great. That was sometimes I just messed up the closing on these shows. That was Phil Doherty and Norman Joyner talking to us about Containership and making a much better pitch than they made on their website. So, Jonathan, what do you think? Will I get reset here?
They said something really interesting at the end there, and that is that people thought they were crazy for the first, couple of years that they were running this, and then everyone is caught up. And it seems like that is a really good position to be in, where you're the only ones pushing something, and then suddenly it becomes the big thing, because, you know, that means that you're the one out front doing it. And so it's a really good position for them, and you know, I'm really glad that they are pushing a lot of it as open source, and it sounds like they're doing it the right way, such that, you know, somebody can actually pull all of their source and use it. And, you know, it's not just open source as a fad, but they're actually trying to make it available so people can work with it. So really interesting guys. It's a good show.
Yeah, and I like that, you know, it's kind of like we go through these waves every few years of what the next thing is. You know, we started with virtual machines, and then we started moving towards containers, and then we started moving towards orchestration of containers. But this may be the next wave, and they may be catching it right at the top of I think it's what you want to do as a surfer, right? Catch it at the top of the wave? Yeah, probably. I don't know. I'm not a surfer. So, yeah, you want to be up on the top. I think that's probably the right thing to do. The whoosh goes by, right? So they're catching it at the top. And I wish them all the luck that I can. And hopefully this show will give them a bump of the people who are interested in what they're doing. But it sounds like they've got some pretty big customers anyway. So it looks like they'll be around for quite a while, which sounded good. So anything else before I run down the upcoming guests?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You talked about In the IT world, the computing world, we've seen a lot of abstraction over the years. You know, you could see the first, you know, IBM compatible PC, those coming along that in some ways abstracted away the BIOS and the hardware, and then VMs fully abstracted away hardware. You didn't have to worry about it anymore. And then, you know, containers have abstracted away the operating system. Well, now we've seen that these guys are abstracting away even the cloud provider that you're on. And so I think it's kind of it is the next step. It's interesting to think through it that way.
Now, you could make a lot of money if you could figure out what the next thing is after this, because I think this is going to be important for a while, but it's got to be the next step after this. So we'll see how that goes. So great, great. Good show. And thank you for the your comments and your questions as well. But let me tell you who's coming up, because I'm always excited about that. Next week, we're going to have allthingsopen.org. That's a show that happens in the Research Triangle. They've actually been running on for 5 years, and they have like 3,000 or 4,000 attendees. So it's like one of the biggest open source shows out there. And I didn't know anything about it until I bumped into some people at OSCON talking about it. So I'm actually attending coming up in, I guess it's the middle of October. We're going to have a couple people next week actually talking about who's there, who's keynoting. You can still get tickets. We're going to give a discount to people who listen to Floss Weekly. That's what I'm told. They haven't told me yet, though, but they said they will. And all sorts of wonderful things. So anyway, that's next week. 2 weeks from now, LibreOffice, which, of course, was the hostile fork of OpenOffice, one of those things that has to happen from time to time. Like we had Jenkins last week being a hostile fork. A Kazoo update. That show has actually been moved not on Wednesday, but to Thursday. So we've had a little bit of conflict in the network schedule. So we're moving to Thursday just for that show only. I have just reconfirmed that it will actually be the return after many years that we've missed him of our own Dan Lynch. He actually was on the two previous times that we've had Kazoo and 2600 Hertz on this show. And so I said it would only be appropriate if Dan could make a drop in. This won't be a regular thing, but his health has been an issue for a while. But he's coming back just for that show. He says, I think I can do this. I think it's going to be just fine. So that's going to be amazing. I'm really looking forward to that show. Just like I'm always looking forward to every show. Let's level the playing field here. I don't want to diss any other particular show, but I am looking forward to that show. I'm looking forward to working with Dan again. Hiawatha Web Server, a security-focused web server. Aquameta, which is a web dev and environment designed around Postgres, friendup.cloud, which is a desktop in a browser tab, and more. Just added to the schedule, in fact, minutes before this show started, the creator of libgit2, which is basically an abstraction of Git as a library, so you can do all the Git operations in your Git repos. Already been embedded in a number of technologies, like GitLab uses it, a bunch of other things use it, a lot of desktop tools use it. So rather than actually calling out to actual Git commands, they do the same operations, but with this library. It looks really, really cool. Been in heavy industrial use. And then wrapping up the currently scheduled schedule is Crail, which is high-performance storage and networking. You can see all these names and more, get details about the names I just listed by going to the homepage for this show, twit.tv/floss. And from there is a link to who's on our upcoming guest list. If you have projects that want to be hosted on Floss Weekly, interviewed on Floss Weekly, we can do that. The way to do that is to have the project leader or community coordinator email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My address is right there on that page, so you don't have to remember it. Don't have to write it down. Just remember twit.tv/floss. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We took a number of questions from there. That's actually always true because zero is also a number. So I just figured that out on some previous show. We took a number of questions, even if it was zero. They let anybody do this show. Okay, so wrapping up here. Follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. I'm going to be at Dragon Con in just a few weeks. I'm on. I'm actually a panel coordinator, and I'm on two other panels, and I'm giving my Why Dart Should Be Your Next Programming Language one-hour talk as my own solo project there. Following that, I'll be at the Open Source Summit in L.A. I think it's coming up in 3 or 4 weeks. I'm going to be at the allthingsopen.org conference. And I'm currently in discussion with possibly going back to Brazil. They may or may not have funding. They're supposed to let me know yesterday, but that hasn't come through. So my guess is maybe not. But because the show they have dates already. It's like October 1 through 4, and it's August already. You don't plan international travel that close in. So they better tell me within the next week or two, yes or no, to see if I'm going to go. So that's kind of the way that's working. Anything you want to plug? I was going to say Norman, but that's like Norman, Oklahoma now, which is not.
I've been there.
Anything you want to plug, Jonathan?
Nope. The only thing I'll say is that follow me from my random musings at JP_Bennett on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Thanks once again for jumping in on the to be a co-host this week, and hopefully we can give you a rest next week. But we'll see. It's Jonathan. Thanks once again.
Yes, sir. Good to be here.
All right. Awesome. And we'll see you all again next week. If you can put up with me one more time, we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.